Welcome to the Beekeeper's Corner Podcast. February 9th, 2014, episode 51, Swarmalicious. Hello again and welcome once more to the Beekeeper's Corner Podcast. Today, I'm recording this episode on the day it will be released. That is, if I can get to producing it tonight. Sometimes I do that, and sometimes I don't. But it's always fascinating to try and do it in one day. I suppose it's not pleasurable to hear somebody whine, but it's snowing again outside tonight. And I think I know how people feel in Seattle about the rain. While we can go outside, many of us here in New Jersey are tired of it being in the single digits at night and high only below freezing, 32 or below Fahrenheit. As a beekeeper, I think the best thing for our bees is if they could survive the winter is to have a really cold winter. Anecdotally, I think the strongest springs come after the harshest winters, but boy, I think we're ready for a break. So we're in winter mode and dreaming of the dandelions, but that won't stop us from talking about bees and bringing some insights on our local notions around here, so let's get started. Our features for this episode, I'll bring you the results of the 2013 New Jersey Swarm Report. We'll talk about the potential way to resolve a varroa problem through gene manipulation. For Roundtable, we'll follow up to the wax preparation feature from episode number 50. Shake, shake, shake. I'll talk about getting ground pounding sound for your next event. Too Much of a Good Thing, a sidebar on a production issue with the Jason Bruns interview. I'm going to Plan B for spring preparations due to the weather. A commentary on sponsorship, and we'll close off with a synopsis of the NJBA winter meeting and other odds and ends. But first, as usual, the local hive report. For the local hive report, there's just a handful of things to talk about. It's been snowing a lot here in New Jersey. We've had three or four different snowstorms each time I've gone out subsequently to check on the hives and make sure they're in good shape, roofs are on, things like that. Everything's been in good shape so far. Had one warm flying day, went out and listened, looked, observed the hives. You know, one of the things we're looking for, as we said on the last podcast, is whether or not they're removing dead bees from the hive itself. There's a huge pile out in front of hive number two. There's a small pile out in front of hive number three. Not much going on in front of hive number one. I did see all three of those hives flying, and that's a good sign. What is a concern is we had one hive that was caught in June. It was a swarm hive. It never really grew out of the first box, so we put it on top of hive number three. Thus far, it's been kicking along. I've been seeing activity on it, but this warm day, I didn't see anything going on with it. The question is, are they just staying on the cluster trying to do whatever they can to stay warm, or are they perished? I can't really tell. I took a stethoscope out to listen, and I should stop for a second and say, last time I went out with a probe thermometer and stuck it inside the hive, and it immediately went up. So I'm pretty confident it was alive 2 weeks ago. This time, although I didn't see any activity on the warm day, I took a stethoscope and listened to each of the hives, and I could hear operation going inside. Especially hive number two was very loud, and they were up in the second box. Hive number two has two deep boxes and two mediums with honey on top. And then it's got the quilt box on top with insulation. So it seems to be in really good shape. Well, I listened to hive number three and I could hear the bottom. And I listened to hive number two, and the question was I hearing the bottom of the hive, or was I hearing what was in that box? It was hard to determine. One interesting note, if you think about the way the hives are situated, I listened from the front, from the side, facing where the sun comes up, and the back and the far side, away from the sun. All three of the hives, I could hear activity against the sun side, but couldn't hear it on the far side. So it seems like they're all favoring the one side there, which is interesting. I guess it'll play out whether I'm having illusions here or not when I open the hives and look to see where the clusters are, but I think I know where I can expect to find them. So three hives still kicking here, middle of February or beginning of February. I'm looking for that first warm day. As I said, I have some feed to put on them just to make sure that they're going to get it to March. And this is the time where they're building their spring bees, is my guess, if they could get off the cluster, if the warmth would come back. Looking at the patterns for the weather, it looks like maybe 2 weeks from now we're going to start getting into 45 degree days, maybe highs of 50 on occasion. So if they could hold out just another 2 weeks, we'll get some feed on them and then they'll be good to go. My preference would be not to feed. If you've listened to me in the past, you know that I don't ever want to do that. But given that these hives were robbed pretty severely right at fall, I'm just hoping that they don't collapse at the end here. But so far, so good. So that's it for the local hive report. Segment number one, the New Jersey Swarm Report. I had a chance yesterday to get some FaceTime in front of the New Jersey Beekeepers Association. Last year, if you've listened to the podcast, you might recall in April we started an endeavor to encourage people to report any swarms that they either captured or physically saw. I was able to go through last week and collate the numbers in anticipation of presenting this topic and encouraging beekeepers to come in for the 2014 season to see how we could improve the situation. At the onset of the discussion, I asked for a show of hands about how many people captured a swarm, and in a room of about 120-ish people, half of them had raised their hand. When asking how many in that room had reported a swarm to the swarm report, I think the number was probably about in the 20s or so. Not a big percentage, and that was the purpose of the discussion. The logical progression of things is late winter, stage one, they move up into the honey dome. Then they start to grow and grow, and eventually, and in our time frame here in New Jersey, somewhere around March 15th, they're going to get to the point where they're going to swarm. And you've done all this work for winter bees just to have them swarm off in the spring just as the nectar flow is rolling. So it doesn't make a lot of sense for people not to do swarm preparation. And in that context, one of the things that would be most helpful is to have an insight of when swarming starts to kick off. Now, maybe you're not going to get a lot of value out of 13 or 14, but as we get a couple years of data, we should see some consistent patterns, and you'll be able to look and say, in your area, hopefully, you'll have a general idea of when the swarm season starts. So we went over the swarm report rationale. It was open to all beekeepers. Again, we want you to report a physical swarm or something that you've seen. One of the things that I had to say to the audience is this is not exact science. This isn't research. And, you know, people could potentially see the same swarm. That's possible. The numbers are going to be inaccurate. But for the most part, it's really about seeing the swarm that we're looking for. And the other data that comes along with it is useful, but you have to take it with a grain of salt. 19 of the 21 New Jersey counties reported a swarm last year, and ultimately what we're trying to determine is if there are trends that could emerge from the capture of this data. We're using a SurveyMonkey tool, funny name for that. That's a commonly known survey engine that's free on the web, and we're asking simply five questions. What county the swarm was collected in, on the date that it was captured or observed, and what the swarm location was. So this is an interesting dynamic, one you had to think about. We ask for the physical address, the city, town, state, zip. Some people don't necessarily want to put their address in. That's okay. It's optional if you do that. For us, though, we have to have the city and the town or the data is not meaningful. 82% of the respondents, and we got 135 responses last year, entered a physical address. So that's kind of cool that people are doing that. And if you're watching from your locale, we posted weekly a map with a plot of all the reports that we got. You could physically see what's going on in your town or your municipality, your county, so to speak. So you could also go look at the data, and if you recognize the addresses, you could tell if your friends are reporting swarms. So the other questions that we ask, what was the swarm size? Is it small, is it medium, or large? And I'll define that in a second. And what was the height of the swarm? Was it somewhere in reach from the ground, meaning 6 feet or lower? Was it reachable by a ladder, meaning 6 feet to 10 feet? Or was it higher than that, somewhere up in a tree or on a building or things like that? So going through the swarm data and saying who did the yeoman's job last year, of the 135, Atlantic County and Burlington County in New Jersey were the ones that had the biggest reports. They had 18 each. And then comes Hunterdon County with 12, Monmouth and Somerset with 11. Now, 135 swarms, I think that's a good dry run. I don't think there's any meaningful patterns that we could establish from that. Ideally, if we can get this thing well known in the state, we could potentially get thousands of reports of swarms, and that would be useful because then real patterns would emerge. And an interesting side topic with Tim Stewart, one of the commercial guys in New Jersey, saying it'd be funny to see what would happen in Hamilton, New Jersey, down by the blueberries when all the guys were seeing swarms from all the commercial pollinators that are brought in there. But my commentary to him is I don't think the commercial guys are going to stop, pick up the phone, or go to the internet and start reporting swarms. So I think we're safe on that. And looking at the swarm frequency results, we started a little bit late. In fact, we started at the end of April, and it so happens that that week that we captured was the highest week that we had. From April through May and into June and late June, you saw a definitive slope downwards to the point where you got to July and it was incidental reporting in New Jersey. Now, we had a really funny July last year. It was really hot. August was a dearth. And then it ramped up a smidge in September through the honey flow that we had in New Jersey. And then it just tapered off altogether. So all this data is actually available on the NWBA, Northwest Beekeepers Association website, and I'll give a link to that at the end if you want to see the slides and get the insights on the numbers that were reported if you're in New Jersey. The question about height, if you think about it, ground was the best answer. 57 of the 135 responses were less than 6 foot. Somewhere in the middle, 32 were less than 10 feet, the ladder height that I mentioned. And actually, we got more responses for tree than ladder at 46. So 46 tree, 57 ground, ground being the highest, and 32 for the responses of I need a ladder. The next question answered that we could glean data from was the swarm size. And here we said small, medium, or large. Well, what does that mean? Small is smaller than a grapefruit, medium is grapefruit size to a basketball size, and large is bigger than a basketball. So here the numbers were 8 for small, medium overwhelmingly 1 with 85 reported in that size frame, and bigger than a basketball, large, was a number of 42. And that number, if you go in the order of precedence, medium 1, large was 2nd, small was 3rd. The other data set that we were able to get is kind of questionable, but I put it in here anyway, and it turned out to be what I would have thought it had been, and that is the time that the swarm was reported. So you not only enter the date, but you can actually enter the time on which you see or captured the swarm. And in this data, 2 p.m. in the afternoon was the highest number. So there was some commentary from the audience, rightfully so, about this is a funny thing to put in here because does that just mean that everybody goes out at 2 o'clock and that's when they saw the swarm, so therefore it's the highest number. Unless you're seeing the swarm issue from the hive, you don't know how long it's been sitting on the tree. It could have just got there, or it could be there and going to leave any moment before you intervene. I think this one, of all the data, it comes with a grain of salt, right? It's useful to know, but I don't think we can really lean on this. So, if you see a swarm in New Jersey in 2014, you can go to our website, surveymonkey.com/s/swarm, or swarm 2014, I haven't figured out the URL yet, and you can report a swarm there, and then you can go to nwba.njbeekeepers.org, and you can follow along if you're in New Jersey or elsewhere, if you're interested in following. Ironically, this week something came through about some swarm reporting feature coming out of, I thought it was Europe, but somebody told me it was Australia. And it's similar to ours, but asks some different questions, and you could tell by the language and the commentary and the measurements, sizes, that it was not U.S.-based. I guess this is going to become commonplace, or an idea that maybe somebody even heard me talking about it last year. That's self-aggrandizing, but it's all possible that we're going to start seeing these often. One of the things that concerns me about a swarm report coming out of UK or Australia and being advertised to New Jersey or to US in general is fatigue. We have the winter death loss survey here in New Jersey. We have all the Be Informed partnership surveys. And unless this person's going to provide meaningful data back to the entire community in a subset that's useful to them, I think it's kind of odd that they're soliciting the United States from abroad, but that's one person's opinion. Anyway, I thought it was a good start to the 2014 swarm reporting season. Got some positive feedback through it, and I had a chance also, as a side note, to build out some slides for this using some new graphic design ideas. Flat design is in right now if you've seen iOS 7 or Windows 8, and built this slide deck from that, and I think it looks pretty good, pretty flashy, and hopefully when people see this they'll think it's attractive and come back and look at the swarm report. So check it out. We'll provide a link to the show notes where you can go take a look at the results. And if you're in New Jersey, the way I ended the meeting was, on my honor, I promise to pledge to report to my swarms in the New Jersey Swarm Report. It's just a little funny commentary there. For segment number two, exterminate Varroa through science, I came across an interesting but kind of scary premise for eradicating the Varroa mite in our hives. Recent research solved the puzzle for how insects process oils and fats, commonly referred to as lipids in general. They discovered that there is a gene that makes a large protein which is responsible for carrying the lipids in the Varroa mite, and with some creative thinking, this can be used to our advantage. In the Varroa mite, this protein carries the lipids and is present in large amounts when the mites are feeding on the bees. It changes, however, when the mites move into larval bee cells and begin reproducing. The proteins close down, but a different set of proteins kick in, the vitellogenins. That sounds familiar. Vitellogenin is what the bees put on when they're getting into an overwinter state. So these These vitellogenin proteins are responsible for carrying lipids to the ovaries in order to make eggs for the reproductive cycle. In theory, this presents an opportunity. What if one could target that protein and shut down the lipid delivery? Two possible outcomes could result. The mites would starve, or they wouldn't be able to reproduce. The source of what I'm telling you has come by way of Dr. Peter Thiel. Yep, the same guy that did that line in the pan thing I covered from ABF last year. If you're a member of the American Beekeepers Federation, you might have seen this in the August newsletter last year. The article goes on to say that one could attempt to intervene by working with RNAi interference. In summary, silencing the signal that results in the protein is what would happen, and working with RNAi, this is the work that's been used to develop ways to fight cancer, polio, hepatitis, HIV, and so on. And it's also effectively been used to control insect viruses, and scientists have already done work with termites and the western corn rootworms. The good news is, it's like a target painted on the varroa and would not impact non-target organisms if done correctly. Now, I always get a little squeamish at some of these scientific thoughts and refer back to the classic pop culture example of Jurassic Park and one of the most insightful scenes to come out of Hollywood. I'm talking about the lunch scene and a few tasty tidbits that have always stuck with me. Don't you see the danger, John, inherent in what you're doing here? Genetic power is the most awesome force that this planet has ever seen, but you wield it like a kid that's found his dad's gun. And then there's some additional dialogue, and John Hammond, who's the Jurassic Park guy, comes back and says, I don't think you're giving us our due credit. Our scientists have done things which nobody's ever done before. Yeah, but your scientists were so preoccupied about whether or not they could that they didn't stop to think whether they should. That, folks, is classic Hollywood. I guess that's a bit of a Kevin moment there. It'll be interesting to see if someone picks up the notion and does the science on this. I won't speculate if it would be good or bad, but interesting to know the thoughts and science that are constantly working and thinking to solve the problem of our honeybees. I'll provide a link to the show notes to the ABF newsletter. Look for the article in the Science Buzz section. I'll also throw in a bonus, a YouTube link to the lunch scene, which I just decimated, where they are debating the merits of the messing with science. I guess that's odd commentary to end this particular news with. I should say for the record that I'm not against the concept of altering the protein. I do worry about the long-term implication of these things, but do think there's a place in the world for science solving problems. Who wouldn't want the world to continue to solve human diseases, for example? So, okay, thanks for listening on that. So we're going to roll into roundtable here, wax preparation cliff notes. I had a chance to speak with Charles Ilsley recently, a couple times since the last episode that we recorded. He gave me an update on the wax process he was embroiled in. When we left Charlie in the last episode, he was almost to the stage two of his honeybee wax rendering process. He was looking to learn the impact of adding diatomaceous earth to the wax processed in the double boiler. He conveyed to me he was surprised at the output, as it didn't just remove some of the yellows and reds, it resulted in pretty much white wax. And his objective was to leave it like beeswax, yellowish in color, for a honey show. So he was a bit bummed out by the outcome given his objective, but he was happy about learning the discovery nonetheless. You know, I often listen to episodes to proof them during the production, and then screen the final results within days of release, and sometimes I find little things wrong, and trust me, it is brutal hearing yourself on recording for posterity. You know, Charlie and I had a conversational style delivery, and the feedback I received post the episode release that it was hard to put together the wax process formula due to the duration of the segment. And to that end, let me see if I could provide a synopsis here to help listeners out who are trying to decipher that. So step number one, take the collected wax and wash it with warm water. Try to scrub it as much as possible to get the detritus off and see what you can get off of the wax to get it clean on your first pass. Step two in Charlie's process was put the wax in a pouch and drop it into boiling water. Charlie cautioned that the wax should not sit down on the bottom per se, as it will burn if it reaches too high of a temperature. The pouch he used was made of cheesecloth, but you could use a nylon stocking or other fine mesh strainers. Boil the product until it melts in the water. His timing was 5 to 7 minutes. And once it's melted out of the pouch, remove the pouch from the water, and the filtered materials will be inside the pouch. Charlie said his outcome looked akin to what you'd see from an owl pellet after it consumed a rodent, hair, scale, and other parts and pieces. If you think about that, that's something not to be unexpected, because some of that capping or some of your wax that you might throw in could come from brood comb or other places, so contamination would come by means of whatever you're putting in there. Let me not get off topic here. Step three, take that pot off the heat and let it cool down. The wax will, and this is my term, congeal on the top, and during its drying out process, it will squeeze excess water out. So step number four, cut the wax and let it sit at least 24 hours to dry out. So you're cutting around the outside edge, detaching it if it's not floating in the water, pulling it out, and putting on a rack or something to dry. Step number five, turn the wax over, and if need be, scrape the detritus off on the bottom. So sometimes the stuff that's in the water will float up and attach to the bottom layer. And if it was dirty wax, you can opt to pouch water wash it again. And Charlie recommended that. You could just keep running it through that process to filter as much as possible through that means. Step number six, set up a double boiler and heat the wax until it melts. Leave it in the double boiler for a period of time, and this will evaporate off any excess water. Then pour the hot mixture through a paper towel or other product to further filter it. And you could stop here, but Charlie mentioned some additional steps if you wanted to go further. Step number seven, either keep it in the double boiler or return it to the double boiler and... Whenever I say this, I want to mix the words. You want to melt the wax, not welt the max. When the melted mix is ready to go, put some diatomaceous earth or activated charcoal. You could stir these around inside the wax. They'll further reduce and trap moisture and particulate matter, and then pour it again through some type of paper towel or filter to finish up the refining step. If you missed the episode, the whole purpose of this was to get your wax squeaky clean. This wax will be pure and perfect for cosmetics, candles, and any other uses where beeswax is used. So one last thing to close this out, Charlie wanted me to share what temperatures are paramount. Let me say that again. Charlie wanted me to share that the temperatures that he mentioned were paramount. Water boils at 212, wax melts at 175, and in the boiler you can get it too hot and actually burn the wax. It'll turn brown, it'll smell bad. So maintain your temperatures using a thermometer, and you don't want to burn it or discolor it. It's not very good. And while it might seem extreme, the thermometer is a wise investment here and a good tool to have in your toolbox. You could also use it, by the way, for honey products that you're using. If you're making candy or you're making lip balm, things like that, you still have to melt the wax for those uses. So hopefully that helps you out in a little bit shorter of a duration. And you can get to processing some of your own wax. Round table number two, I call this one Bring on the Boom. I think I mentioned here before that our association did a movie night and it just went terrible. The problem at hand was trying to get the sound to cover the room. And there was consensus after the session that we needed to take action if we're going to have any chance of having an effective meeting. I went on the watch for technology and sound system and speakers on a quest, so to speak, to figure out what to purchase, as this is in an area that I have a lot of experience in. I pondered different solutions. At first I looked at a whole house daisy chain system like a Sonos, then Bluetooth stereo speaker sets, and then eventually PA systems coupled with amplifiers and mix panels. In the end, and after reading a lot of guidance and reviews, our association purchased a Behringer B215D 550 watt PA speaker system. I'll do my Tim Allen. The appeal of this unit was that it was a combination amplifier speaker, and all you have to do is plug in a microphone and you're good to go. You didn't need an amplifier separate. You don't need mix panels unless you're getting really ambitious. The box and the speaker stand package literally arrived the day of the meeting that we were going to use it. And I was caught off guard about how big this puppy was. It's 27 inches tall and it weighs 32 pounds. It's not lightweight and for the faint of heart. But dang, it's a powerful speaker. Dang! It's big enough and powerful enough to get a grin out of Tim the Tool Man. Yeah. I did a test run with our wireless lavalier microphone system in the house and shook the house from the foundation that afternoon. So satisfying. It has a port for an XLR microphone cable, or you could plug in a quarter-inch adapter. XLR is the three-pronged adapter that plugs into the bottom of a microphone. So that night, we used it to cover a high school cafeteria, and the single speaker was at half volume and more than adequate. I guess one of the concerns is that if we ever did crank it up, whoever was sitting next to it would have their hair parted. You know, we discussed internally and planned to augment the system with a little brother speaker, something that will suffice for a small venue, and augment the other side of the room should we ever be presenting in a cave, you know, like the venue we had the movie in last year. The problem with that venue was we were in the cafeteria at my son's local school, and it has a super high ceiling, and it had a curtain hanging across the front that covered a stage that absorbed all the sound, and the acoustics were just terrible. I am positive this speaker will cover that room next time we go back there. So other than the weight, it suits the purpose perfectly, and it's great to have the right equipment for the job. The speaker was $329 US from Amazon, and according to reviews, it's so durable that it will last a lifetime. If you're interested, we'll have a description of the model and a link to it in our show notes. And I have to say, it was very gratifying that night at North Hunterdon High School where we had our session. We had our wireless microphone system, our stereo running, I was shooting video, and everything worked perfectly. We'd been talking about this for probably 2 years, trying to figure out how to solve getting sound to the audience, getting sound to the video camera, getting a good video camera shot, and that one night everything worked flawlessly. So very exciting for our association to have these capabilities. Round table number 3, I call this one, huh? What? Huh? The speaker solution was on a to-do list, and now that's checked off. And I have one other thing among many things to do, and that's to reproduce the Jason Bruns interview. I recorded that episode using a plugin for Skype called CallGraph. The utility has its plus and minuses, as it turns out. When Jason and I spoke, CallGraph captured the conversation on separate channels, left and right. Everything I said, me personally, was on the left side, and everything Jason said was on the right side. I loaded the captured audio in the production audio tool that I use called Audacity, and was able to clean up the extraneous noise on one channel while the conversation was going on the other channel. Coughs, my squeaking chair, typing on the keyboard, all silenced to make a better production. I made all the corrections and exported the segment for inclusion into the episode. So I listened to it in my truck, and after a few minutes I was tired of me coming out of the left and Jason coming out of the right. And I also heard from a handful of listeners that they, too, were very disturbed by the way it was produced. I'll go back at some point when I get a free moment and reproduce the episode to merge the channels and put them on both sides. For those that listened to it, hopefully you got through it, but I'll assure you that we won't do that again. Thanks to the listeners who wrote in and provided feedback about this. Live and learn. Live and learn. Roundtable number 4. This one's called Plan B. I'd been hoping for a moderate day temperature-wise so I could go out and assess some of the equipment and consider getting some woodworking done. My tools are in a garage and it's been 30 degrees, so I've stayed away. And today I threw in the towel and cleaned out my basement workshop. I have a little room in the back with a bench, and I could do some work in there if need be. The problem is, that workspace is a flat surface. Things that need to be hidden from view get loaded into the table, and the workspace becomes storage. I spent the afternoon today hoeing it out and spiffing it up. You know, I don't know why I didn't do it before, as it looks spectacular. I love a neat and tidy workspace. So now I have a place to operate. I went outside and I pulled a number of nuke boxes and medium supers that need to be painted, and little by little I'll sneak away and give them some love this week. I'm also in the market for some frames, as I need to fill out a couple empty boxes, and will likely be getting to that too. All my push is because I know that March 15th is coming and I want to get to my stuff early this year. So I've been having some notions about the Ware hive that I was going to build. I still haven't secured the wood for it and started with that. It's been too dang cold to go out in the garage and work. And I have to believe that things are going to sneak up on me. One of the things I need to do out in my apiary is to pull back some of the weeds in the area where I'm expanding it. And I also have to do some research on the bear fence that I want to put in. And yes, this is the year, folks. Write it down. Write it in ink. We're putting a bear fence up. So I got to clean that area up. And I think when the warm weather breaks, I'll have enough activities that I don't know if I'm going to get out to get a Ware hive. The other thing is, as I looked at what it takes to engineer one of those, for the amount of time, me personally, I could spend, and the amount of money on materials and whatever, I really do think buying a commercial one might be the better answer. I certainly don't have money to burn, but that being the case, I would consider that purchase somewhere along the line. And the other thing is, I have my styrofoam hive that I just purchased and I'm doing experimentation with, and my long hive to put out, along with my mediums and other stuff, so maybe the Ware will have to wait. We'll see. I am interested in that still in a big way. I might just make a push somewhere along the line and get it done. But nice to have the workshop back in order in the basement, and I'll spend some nights this week painting out some hive equipment. Roundtable number 5, I wanted to talk about some insider stuff. Just some musings from me about podcasting. I was recently contacted by a podcast sponsor asking if I would be interested in taking on a sponsor for this podcast. And I've always said and always deliberated whether, if that time would come, whether I would do it. I did something unusual recently. I put a donate button on my homepage for my site. And I didn't say anything about it. Never. It's been there a while, but, and I haven't received a donation yet. But there are times when I spend a lot of money and get talked to from Sharon in producing the podcast, buying equipment, speakers, microphones, and the like. And having a sponsor would help defray some of that stuff. It would also let me buy products to test and talk about. I just mentioned in the previous segment buying a styrofoam hive. So why would somebody buy a styrofoam hive? Well, my notion is that they're junk. That's what I hear all the time. They're terrible. They're no good. They're not useful. They don't breathe. They don't do whatever. In fact, I had a conversation yesterday with a commercial beekeeper about that, and he went through the common, you know, thoughts and processes of that. My thought is, here's the backstory on this. That hive that I purchased is being used in Europe. And in fact, if I'm to believe the person who told me this, the hive is replacing woodenware because people are getting huge longevity, they're getting great temperature controls and things like that. Bees are doing well in them and so on. So it piques my curiosity, and the only way to know was not to listen to somebody, but to buy one and put bees in it and figure out what's going on. The thing's not cheap. I have to go buy some masonry paint and paint it and so on. So the notion of bringing a sponsor on board for the podcast is an interesting notion. Now, I sent a note back asking some details about it, and I never heard back from them. So the question is, did they forget me? I don't know what happened. But it did start me on this philosophical journey about what do I think about taking on a sponsor. I've always said I would have no problem sponsoring someone, mentioning someone for products that I use and would endorse without any cash. So, for example, the Easy Pry Hive tool. I got one of those somewhere, and I love the thing. And now it's starting to be for sale in catalogs. And I joke with Tim Schuller, the state apiarist, all the time. Like, Tim, did you get yourself an Easy Pry yet? And I saw the lady in the show, and she saw my video that I put up and heard the commentary and thanked me and offered me one, and I didn't take it, but that type of thing I don't have qualm about. And if she gave me one, I suppose I wouldn't complain about it, but philosophically, I'm not looking to sponsor. If I put a sponsor in the show, it would be something that I use and believe in and could endorse. I don't think it could work any other way. But anyway, interesting thoughts rumbling through my brain about that. And I guess I'll continue to keep the notion, wonder if that person will ever come back to me and offer, and I'll have to make a decision. So just thought I'd share that with you. I don't know if anybody finds this useful, but I did get a question from someone recently about how to do podcasting, and I did say some of what I would share on this is the trials and tribulations for podcasting. To that note, I mentioned before I've been trying to find a way to make the website easier. Everything that's on my website I've written by hand, coded literally, and thinking about going to a content management system, something like WordPress, but can't get the look or feel. And also, it's a lot of money to pay for the hosting that I'm doing now, but I get unlimited volume and downloads, and nobody's ever complained about, you know, the show has gotten enough that I'm getting 5,000 downloads a maybe more than that a week, and that's a lot of bandwidth, and some providers would probably complain about that. So I'm wondering if I can find a solution for that, right? So there's the backstory about podcasting is the support infrastructure besides the stuff of just standing behind the mic is always interesting, and I thought I'd share a little insider with you. So roundtable number 6, last episode was way too long, in my opinion, so I'll keep this one a little bit shorter and we'll have a little yin and yang. I had another feature set up to go here, but I'm going to hold off and bring it back for 52. I wanted to produce that in a certain way, and it's didn't have the chance, my fault, to have it come together, so we'll hold off. And it has to do with spring preparation and swarm prevention. Give you a little teaser on that. The NJBA winter session, winter meeting, was yesterday in Hamilton, New Jersey, and it was a really good session. Not that it's a surprise to me, but I always think when I go to these meetings, I'm not sure what I'm going to get out of them, and I always come away surprised that there's so much information. In this one, the featured speaker was Lincoln Sennett from Swan's Honey in Maine. Lincoln had an incident last year where one of his vehicles had a problem on an interstate, spilled some bees, and the New Jersey Beekeepers Association, along with the state apiarist, went through and did some help there to try and right the situation. From that, the state apiarist report indicates that they have a swarm response plan for New Jersey, and they've refreshed the contacts, and I've been, I think, fortunate enough to be asked to participate in that. So if it ever happens, I have my gear in my truck and I'll be right there, like the old rescue squad days. That'd be kind of funny for me as a former EMT to get the call and have that adrenaline rush to go take care of a situation. But anyway, Lincoln has a fascinating operation up there. He's growing blueberries. He's doing honey. He's doing pollination services. He's got over 1,000 hives. This is really bad that I don't remember. It was 1,000 or 2,000 hives. And he went through a number of discussion points about how he's wintering his hives and some things that he's put together creatively, like modified inner cover and different ways to feed. And even his daughter, 16-year-old daughter, created a hive stand that was really ingenious. It's a two-part hive stand. It's all one big piece, but it has two platforms. One is the hive is sitting on the platform. The second one has a raised platform. And you have to see the pictures. I can't do it justice in description. But when you peel the top box back, you just tilt it back on its edge. And you could set it on end, and it lines right up on the platform. Or you could physically pick it up and move it over and set it down and stack your hives there. And it was a really neat contraption. So Lincoln gave a great presentation. I shot video on it. I'll go back and pull some notes out of it for next episode to give you some of his highlights. And you'll also be able to see the video by then, is my guess. Dave Frank talked about the legislation that's going on in New Jersey. I've mentioned that here on the podcast. Unfortunately, it didn't get processed this year, so it's going back through. And a lot of work is being done by several key individuals in the state to... The premise of this is to centralize, at least in my mind, and I don't want to diminish anything that's being proposed, but the more important aspect is who calls the shots on how bees are managed in New Jersey. Is it done at local municipal home rule, or is it done at the state level by the state agricultural boards or the state agricultural I don't know the right term, I'm a little tired, folks, bear with me. Ag board, that's wow. To me, that seems like the right answer. The premise of that is that there's one consistent methodology, and the other thing that's been brought out in some of the discussion is when you think about how a municipality goes about this, what do municipal officials know about beekeeping? Even if they have an animal control officer, most of them are looking at dogs and cats and knows nothing about how honeybees are. There's some strange rulings that go on in municipalities around the world and in New Jersey. And there's also some unusual behaviors in the means of writing ordinances. One such ordinance that gets called out as an example in New Jersey is you have to have your queens marked. Well, who's coming around to check them? And what if your hive swarms and you don't mark your queen? Does that mean they're going to give you a summons? I mean, all kind of fascinating topics. So we'll see how that progresses. I'll be bringing that news as it continues down its path this year. Joe Alvarez did something on the New Jersey Crop Block Grant. They have an interesting program where New Jersey Beekeepers Association is using this grant to grow products, plants that are native to New Jersey, and the Beekeepers Association branches will be given these plants to give out to the public to increase forage in the state of New Jersey and replace habitat. That's a great program, and Joe did an incredible presentation yesterday. The Constitution for New Jersey Beekeepers Association needed a little bit of work. A committee has been together for a full year scrubbing that, and going through it, they've made a number of changes which got passed, but the big changes got announced yesterday and passed, so congratulations to all involved. I did the swarm presentation that I mentioned a little bit earlier, and Sergio Matula, I'm hoping I'm pronouncing his name properly, from Melvino Meadery, which will be New Jersey's first commercial meadery, presented yesterday afternoon, and had a chance to have a brief conversation with Sergio yesterday, and he mentioned during his talk he's listening to a bunch of beekeeper podcasts because he's getting interested in keeping bees for himself. Winemaker by background, the family made wine, he made wine, and he's making mead, but he's not a beekeeper, and he's going to change that this year. They also had a bee program associated with their winery and, or with their meadery. And again, I'll go through the and present, pull their presentation up, put it up on our YouTube channel and make some commentary here. But Sergio commented that he does listen to this podcast, which I always find interesting when people mention that to me. So here's a tip to you, Sergio. Great work yesterday. Really looking forward and talk to Sergio, and hopefully we can get him on the podcast here to come talk about making mead. So great meeting yesterday. Tim Schuller gave his State of New Jersey, State of the State, or State of the Union report, and we have that presentation to bring out too. So a lot of content out of yesterday's meeting to bring back after it gets processed, and probably look for that in our next episode. I think it's about time to wrap things up. I will say there's a number of emails that have come through, and if you're waiting on me, sorry, I haven't had a chance to dig in recently. I hope that I'll get to some of these soon. I know Sean Williams, Jason Bruns sent me some swarm plans for swarm traps. And yesterday, actually, I saw an interesting one from Lincoln Senate. He was making out of Coroplast, which is that plastic material that they use for signs. I've always said that you can go get those signs after an election and make something out of them. Well, he was making nukes out of them. And I asked him if he had any chance to consider those for swarm capture, and he said by all means they would work for that, and people are using them. So interesting stuff. I also got a message from Dave Culbert. He's the guy who put his mercury on my hive stands to prove that they were strong enough. He said his are doing really well, and he's going to build some more this year. And that's another thing I have to get to, I think, is if I'm going to build them. Although I think I might try the ones from Lincoln's daughter, because I thought they were really neat, and I think they would be neat to try out. So anyway, if you're in the inbox, hang on there. I'll get to you soon enough. And thanks for writing in. I guess before I leave, I'll send a note to say if you wanted to write us a letter, an email, it's kevin@bkcorner.org. You could visit our website and our show notes at bkcorner.org. This is episode number 51. You could take a look at our videos up on youtube.com/nwnjba. And I will send you there for a mead video that I shot with Roger Garris and his son Scott. Really good video. Came out pretty well. Very happy about that. And there's a couple other videos up there recently posted. And then you could follow us, although I haven't been overly active, sorry about that, on our Facebook page, facebook.com/beekeeperscorner. I've been looking for material, and the funny thing is I don't post anything just for the fact of posting. I'm trying to find stuff that I think you'll find interesting or that will be useful to you, and there's just been a dearth lately of any information coming out for beekeeping, and I don't want to post for post's sake, but when I do find things that I find interesting or can offer commentary, I'm putting it up on our Facebook page between episodes. And you know, typically 1, 2, 3, 5 things a week, depending on what's going on. But these last 2 weeks, it's been a little bit dry. I haven't found anything. So not for looking. We'll keep plugging away there. So I guess that's it. I'll wrap up. Thanks, everybody, for listening. We'll be back with episode number 52 in short order. And until next time, appreciate you joining us, and be well.